WPK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Michael Wallace. Longtime Jeffrey Epstein associate Ghislaine Maxwell has been transferred from a Florida prison to a smaller minimum security prison camp with more amenities in Bryan, Texas. CBS's Scott McFarlane has more.
The move happened exactly 1 week after Maxwell and her defense attorney, David Marcus, sat for an interview with Deputy U.S. Attorney General Todd Blanche to talk about her case and the Jeffrey Epstein case. In a statement issued Friday, relatives of Virginia Giuffre, Epstein's most vocal and visible abuse victim, blasted the Trump administration for transferring Maxwell, calling it a horror and outrage and preferential treatment. The president has not ruled out clemency for Maxwell.
We asked Maxwell's defense attorney if a pardon is being discussed or negotiated, and he has not responded.
A Federal Reserve governor has announced she will retire next week. Adriana Kluger didn't give a reason why, but President Trump claims she's stepping down because she disagrees with Fed Chairman Jerome Powell's reluctance to cut interest rates.
I have a open spot on the Federal Reserve Board. I'm very happy about that.
The Fed left interest rates unchanged again this week. In Tel Aviv, protesters greeted U.S. Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff as he arrived to meet with the families of the Israeli hostages still being held in Hamas. Yesterday, he visited a humanitarian site in Gaza and promised to improve the delivery of food to the region. CBS's Deborah Pata.
International experts warned this week that a worst-case scenario of famine is now playing out in Gaza, where aid has either been blocked or severely restricted since March. Ebrahim Daim is an amputee, forced to make this perilous journey for food in his wheelchair to feed his children. I must face death itself just to get a bag of flour. If I don't, we starve, he said. But it is flour mixed with blood.
Bad news for fans of the HBO series And Just Like That.
Showrunner Michael Patrick King says the series will end after the current third season concludes. Sarah Jessica Parker played the Carrie Bradshaw character in And Just Like That and its prequel, Sex and the City, which ran from 1998 to 2004 and also spawned a couple of movies. She called the shows in a post all joy, adventure, the greatest kind. Sex and the City focused on 30-something friends in New York City. The sequel series picked up their lives as 50-somethings.
I gotta stop playing dating bingo.
Michael Toscano, CBS News.
SpaceX's Dragon spacecraft docked with the International Space Station. Four astronauts are replacing a crew that's been up there since March. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
As Wisconsin is saying the word bag instead of bag. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Shelley Pittman. A new study shows most faculty at Wisconsin universities and across the country have serious concerns about the consequences of holding and expressing liberal political viewpoints. Judith Ruiz Branch of the Wisconsin News Connection has more.
The study from Brandeis University aimed to understand what faculty thought about specific political issues and how they taught about them. Research scientist Graham Wright says they found that many hot-button topics rarely come up in classroom settings.
Less than 10% of the faculty we spoke to reported actively teaching about Israel-Palestine, and for three-quarters of them, it just never came up at all. Despite all the discourse about these issues.
He says despite faculty being spoken of as activists, only about 20% of faculty included in the study engaged in any form of political activism or social media posting about current politically contentious topics. The Trump administration is targeting U.S. universities with intense focus on anti-Semitism and diversity viewpoints. Some campuses, including the University of Wisconsin-Madison, have faced federal investigations. Others experienced fines and funding cuts. Study co-author Professor Leonard Sachs says the research suggests these broad measures often affect faculty who aren't contributing to any perceived problems.
What goes on college campuses is very important, and it's now the focus of a debate that oftentimes seems unhinged, where you have the attention being focused on a small number of people, then generalizing it to all campuses.
Sachs says faculty should be viewed as allies, and he's concerned that the future of higher education is currently at stake. Despite the lack of faculty initiation, the majority of those in the study said they are open to students expressing alternative viewpoints in the classroom. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
As Wisconsin is cheering on the Brew Crew, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Hazy sunshine today, a high near 78. Tonight, partly cloudy, 63. Smoky sunshine for Sunday with highs in the upper 70s. 80 on Monday, 82 the high on Tuesday. Mostly sunny and mid-80s on Wednesday.
It's 64 at our studios.
Todd Alba.
Hey everybody, join us Monday for an important show. Measles is on the rise, vaccinations are down. We talk to the folks at Wisconsin Watch what that means for you. Join us.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays 2 to 4. Real news, great conversation from Milwaukee and beyond. 540 WAUK. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this, the second hour of our weekly weekend broadcast, all things rule of law related, government related, justice related. In this, the second hour, we're going to be talking about redistricting and, yes, gerrymandering and things going on in Texas and Louisiana and the Eighth Circuit and maybe in California and Illinois and New York as well. Much in the focus of our nation in this weekend and in the days just ahead. We're also going to talk about tariffs and the intersection between what the president has been doing in one of his major initiatives of his presidency, imposing, withdrawing, delaying, imposing again tariffs as a part of our international policy, our economic policy. Believe it or not, a federal court is now weighing in on that issue as well. And then we're going also going to be talking about birthright citizenship yet again, as appeals courts now also weigh in where the Supreme Court did not. All of that coming up in this hour of Amicus, a law review. You, as always, can be a part of this by sending to Max, my producer, or me a comment in the studio chat line of Civic Media, or also calling in at 855-752-4842. Let's begin with what's going on in Texas and the implications for the rule of law and justice generally. The legislature, as you know, in Texas, just this past week, unveiling a redrawn map reconstituted for the state's United States House districts, proposing to carve up 5 seats. Those are Democratic seats, so that Republicans would now be likely to win them in 2026, November of 26, when all members, all 435 members of the House of Representatives are up for election. The proposed map would propose to provide 5 House representatives in seats that would include Houston and Dallas and along the United States-Mexico border. The redrawn map, condemned by Democrats, not surprisingly, and many others around the country as a badly partisan map, also racially discriminatory, which is very important to understand as we talk through this, at a what's really a rare mid-decade redistricting. As you know, here in the state of Wisconsin, other states throughout the nation, all states, every time a census is done, they look again at their lines inside their particular state and decide whether or not the lines need to be redrawn to ensure, at least the aspiration is, that there is not unconstitutional, shouldn't be political gerrymandering, not racial gerrymandering, that people's voice should be heard when it comes to the people we send to Congress in Washington, D.C., and also, of course, the people we send to the state houses in our state capitals around our country. Pushed for months by President Trump and accepted by the governor there, his name is Greg Abbott, as you know, and other Republican leaders, fulfilling what is generally viewed as the president's demand for five additional Republican seats that he can count on that would help the party keep control when, in fact, all of us go to the polls in early November of 2026 to vote for those 435 members. The president pressing Republicans in the legislature, also in Missouri and Indiana and elsewhere, to follow this lead of Texas. And indeed, Texas is taking the lead. We know that just this past week, the members of the legislature began to have some discussions of a formal nature to discuss this plan, which is out there, which would accomplish, again, these major changes, merging the 35th and 37th districts and accomplishing what could be a political gerrymander, but also, according to some, a racial gerrymander. And indeed, there are allegations that merging the 35th and 37th districts is an illegal voter suppression of Black and Latino votes in Central Texas, and that from the representative named Greg Cesar, who is one of those who is sent to Congress in that one of those districts, along with another representative named Lloyd Doggett, D-O-G-G-E-T-T. They may be forced to run against each other by virtue of this redistricting plan. It appears that the legislature there is going to go ahead and vote on this as soon as this coming week. It is developed in consultation with a national districting trust group. It's a Washington-based group. It could well give Republicans control of 30, count them, 30 of the state's 38 House seats, putting about 80% of the delegation Republican control. In the 2024 election, for what it's worth, Donald Trump carried the state with 56%. Of course, again, it's got to be approved by the committee as it reviews that, then by the full House, the full Senate. All of that is moving forward even this weekend, certainly in the coming week, and likely that there'll be legislative action to redraw the lines mid-term, mid-decade, if you will, in Texas, to redraw lines in a way that arguably, depending upon how this is done, how you construe it, would accomplish a partisan gerrymander by changing the Democratic and Republican weightings in those various districts, but also arguably a racial gerrymander. And that is significant, of course, because the Supreme Court has said to us that generally the federal courts should not be in the business of reviewing partisan gerrymanders, that of a case several years ago, but can indeed review racial gerrymanders if you're doing this for racial purposes. And we know that the Supreme Court and other courts, the lower federal courts, the district courts, they are in business when it comes to that. So as this gets enacted in high likelihood in the coming week, anticipate a judicial challenge right away into one or more district courts in Texas, probably the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the appellate court there, taking this up, arguably ending up in front of the United States Supreme Court. All of this tick-tock, because again, it's got to be in place somehow long before November of next year as we are talking about this and making these changes, likely in August of 25. People have got to know what district they're in. Candidates have got to know this in order for the system to work. Now, why is this so significant, and why does it likely have extensions not just in those other areas that the president has encouraged, Missouri, Indiana, and other places, but we know that the Supreme Court has also weighed in part, or at least dipped its toe into the lake of a case coming out of Louisiana. This is Louisiana versus Calais. We've talked a lot about it. It is a redistricting case coming out of Louisiana. It has to do with the legislature's creation there of two majority Black districts upon the direction of a lower district and appellate court in that part of the world. And curiously, out of the 65 cases that the Supreme Court decided in this past term on its regular merits docket, the Supreme Court specifically did not resolve the challenge to this Louisiana redistricting matter brought by people who maintained that the redistricting accomplished a violation of the Voting Rights Act by inappropriately placing too much emphasis upon race and creating two black majority districts. The Supreme Court on Friday of this past week returned to this Louisiana case by expanding the scope of this Louisiana congressional redistricting dispute that has been pending for months. And specifically, the Supreme Court, again weighing in here in Louisiana, ordered new briefing on a legal question that is implicated in all of these jurisdictions, that is the strength of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The court issued an order specifically asking the lawyers in this case, it didn't send it back, it said, as you come back and argue this case, give us more briefs, write more on this issue of whether in seeking to comply with the 1965 Voting Rights Act that, again, protects minority voting rights and language rights as well, Louisiana, the Louisiana legislature, in creating these two majority black districts, violated the Constitution's 14th and 15th Amendments, both of them, of course, enacted after the Civil War, and doing that to ensure that black voters were treated equally under the law. Is that in fact a violation of the Constitution? And again, there's a lot to unpack here. If the court rules that the state did violate the Constitution by creating those two majority black districts, by affording more people in Louisiana, people of color, the opportunity to have their voices heard, it would mean that states cannot cite the need to comply with the Voting Rights Act if they raise race as a consideration during the map drawing process. There's a lot to unpack there. The upshot is that this Louisiana matter may well once again implicate the legitimacy of the Voting Rights Act, which has been around since 1965, arguably to be invoked as soon as next week in Texas, neighboring state there, when it redescribes its lines, maybe on a partisan basis, maybe on a racial basis. And the matter in Louisiana right now appears to put the constitutionality of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act back in play. We have spoken a lot about Sections 4 and 5 and 2 of the Voting Rights Act in the past. You know well that in a case called Shelby County way back in 2013, the Supreme Court, removed a major tool of the Voting Rights Act that required prior approval to change the ways in which voting is done in those areas of the country, around the country, not just in southern states, that have a history of engaging in violations of voting rights. That was Shelby County. In a case called Brnovich, 2021, coming out of Arizona, they further weakened Section 2, which is the core provision of the Voting Rights Act that ensures or should ensure that people of color have the right to vote. Brnovich, Shelby County, maybe now followed up by this Louisiana matter that they will take up again in this second time, this repeat term coming up, the 2025-2026 term coming out of Louisiana, maybe affecting and diminishing once again the strength of the Voting Rights Act. Now, why is this further important? Because we know that in another matter, yet another matter involving the Voting Rights Act, what did the Supreme Court recently do? We talked about this recently as well. This comes out of the Eighth Circuit. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, basically the breadbasket states right in the middle of our nation, telling the Eighth Circuit that it had to stand down, cannot enforce its finding in a case involving two tribes in North Dakota, Native American tribes of that state, who alleged that there was redistricting that compromised their voting rights in that state. The Eighth Circuit finding that the tribes could not bring the lawsuit to begin with because only the Department of Justice can litigate under the Voting Rights Act. That's what the Eighth Circuit found. Contrary to the law, ever since 1965, the Eighth Circuit, a standalone district, and interestingly, appropriately, our Supreme Court, as a part of its emergency docket, told the Eighth Circuit it's got to stand down, that ruling cannot go forward, but plainly indicating that there will be more action coming out of that ruling of the Eighth Circuit, finding that there can be no enforcement of the Voting Rights Act by private entities, private individuals, only the Department of Justice, and yes, indeed, the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice can litigate, can prosecute civilly under the law. That's a lot. But it means that an awful lot is in play right now when it comes to the Voting Rights Act, that the Texas matter, the challenges made also by other governors in California and Illinois and in New York to do the same thing, to redistrict, all of that placing the Voting Rights Act and redistricting in the rule of law attention of our nation once again. When we come back, some final comments about that, and then we'll move on to tariffs and, yes, again, birthright citizenship. Stay with us for all of that discussion.
You're listening to 540 WAUK, Milwaukee's home for mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
That sound? It's your recycling at work. And you can thank a Wisconsin woman for making it happen. Millie Zantow saw a waste sorting system in Japan during a trip in the 1970s. She came home to Prairie du Sac in Sauk County inspired. Her research led to the triangle-numbered plastic recycling system we still use today. So can you guess what percent of all the plastics produced in the United States ends up being recycled? 75%? 25%? Or 5%? The answer coming up. Zantow also helped with Wisconsin's recycling laws, along with the opening of one of the first collection centers. But now, are you surprised to learn the answer is just 5% of plastics are recycled? It's according to the group Beyond Plastic. Yet Zantow always believed you don't have to be perfect, you just have to start. There's a smart slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
One of the most basic things that a free people could want, not going bankrupt because of healthcare. If it sounds like I'm banging my head against the microphone, yeah, it's that we are having this discussion about having to hold benefits for people because they didn't have proper health insurance coverage, because they're threatened with bankruptcy, which again happens in no other developed country in the world.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Where working people come to talk. It's the Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join me for an honest approach to the issues American working families care about. No talking points, no focus groups. Get ready for a heavy dose of democracy, fairness, grit, and no apologies. It's current affairs from a working class labor perspective. Facts are center, science is real, and everyone gets a seat at the table. The Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Is getting vaccinated on your to-do list? We can help you check that off.
You've got this.
Yes, you do. See how we've got you at yougotthis.usaging.org. A message from the Aging and Disability Vaccination Collaborative, powered by U.S. Aging.
As Wisconsin is cheering on Bucky Badger, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you for once again joining me and Max for a discussion of many things in the areas of rule of law and justice, including redistricting and gerrymandering. A lot of focus right now in the state of Texas. The legislature there, very likely in the coming week, redrawing their lines mid-decade, not obliged to do it, but mid-decade redrawing the lines, according to Democrats, unconstitutionally, unfairly, unreasonably, perhaps creating five new districts that would be solidly Republican, limiting the Democratic stronghold on other seats, requiring some members of the Democratic Party there to face off against each other. Plainly going to be facing a lot of challenges coming out of whatever the legislature does in the coming weeks. That joined by the Supreme Court just this past week resurrecting this case out of Louisiana involving Louisiana and Calais. Mr. Calais alleging, along with 1,100 plaintiffs who they identify as non-African-American voters who feel aggrieved by the decision of the legislature there to create two majority black districts. Is that in violation of the Voting Rights Act? Is that in violation, as they maintain, of the 14th and 15th Amendments? The Supreme Court directing new briefing on those questions just this past week, even as the Eighth Circuit matter that said in a matter that the Supreme Court has shut down, that private parties do not have the capacity to go forward and litigate under the Voting Rights Act, the Eighth Circuit law no longer in place, but arguably to be resurrected down the road. In the midst of all of that, coming out of the Texas action, we've got statements by the governors of California, that's Newsom, by Illinois, that's Pritzker, by New York, that's Hochul, all saying if Texas does this, we're going to fight fire with fire, and we're going to redistrict in our states, presumably to create more Democratic seats in those states to send to the Congress in January of 2027. A fascinating, troubling, concerning time to be looking at all of this. And again, TikTok, because all of this has to happen in some way, shape, or form across the country and maybe other states implicated as well, long before you go to the polls in early November of 2026, so that candidates know what districts they're running in, that voters know what districts they live in, so that they can vote in a way that's consistent with our constitutional principles. And yes, indeed, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, if it survives into the years just ahead. In addition to redistricting, which is indeed a rule of law issue, here is one that you may be surprised to hear about. It has to do with tariffs. You know well the president's focus on tariffs as late as this past week, imposing and changing the numbers of tariffs with respect to specific countries around the world. Just this past week, a federal appeals court, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, hearing arguments in the Trump administration's appeal of a lower court ruling, which we have talked about, a lower court ruling. And the question is whether or not the president has the authority to hit all of these foreign nations with 10% tariffs under something called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or the IEEPA. Now, that's not a household word. That's not a household term. I'll say that once again. It's the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or the IEEPA. And the reason why this is important, of course, is it means that even this issue, the president's authority to set, impose, to negotiate, to change, to amend tariffs and levies against foreign nations, obviously having an implication for all Americans on the dollars that they pay here in our nation, can he do that? Well, you know, the Constitution says no. The Constitution plainly gives the right of what? The Congress itself, the legislature, to impose those kinds of tariffs. And that's where the debate begins. The three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of International Trade had blocked the sweeping duties that the president had asserted previously on most countries, and the Federal Circuit had temporarily reinstated the tariffs while it considered the dispute. So what happens here? Well, what happens is that just this past week, the 11 judges, all 11 of them, of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, they're located in Washington, D.C., they have oral argument on all of this. And as the arguments get underway, several judges on the appeals court pepper the Justice Department lawyer about whether the IEEPA, this statute, authorizes the president to impose these tariffs, when it's clear that the Constitution says just the opposite. One of the judges immediately noted that the law has never before been used to assess the levies on trading partners, says this we've never seen before. Many others talk about the laws that regulate trade that include the word tariff. One of the judges saying it's interesting to him that here the IEEPA doesn't even say tariffs and doesn't even mention tariffs. And pointing to those trade statutes which impose constraints on the duties that a president can assess here, one of the judges goes on to question why a president would rely on those laws when the IEEPA provides broader power under the Justice Department's interpretation. Again, it's a lot. It's a lot going on here. One of the judges says it's a wholesale revision of the scheme that Congress enacted. It's really kind of asking for an extraordinary change to the legislature's approach to the tariff schedule. And the upshot of all of that is, of course, that we've got members of this panel saying that they're very doubtful of the president's capacity to do this under the Constitution and under this particular statute. Other members of the Federal Circuit seem concerned about the breadth of the authority the president is claiming under the IEPA to impose those broad tariffs, and talking about unbounded authority of the president. When you come back, I'll tell you what the government lawyer said in response to that, and again, what the Federal Circuit may well do in telling the president once again what he cannot do in all of this major tariff work that's been occupying our attention in recent months, when we come back here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to Milwaukee's Real News and Great Conversation. 540 WAUK.
CBS News Brief. The Trump administration has transferred Jeffrey Epstein accomplice Ghislaine Maxwell to a different prison without informing the victims amid a firestorm over the president's association with him. CBS's Scott McFarland with more.
The president has not ruled out clemency for Maxwell.
We asked Maxwell's defense attorney if a pardon is being discussed or negotiated, and he has not responded.
A member of the Fed's Board of Governors quit Friday, giving President Trump the chance to fill a vacancy with a new alley as he tries to get the central bank to lower interest rates.
I have a open spot on the Federal Reserve Board. I'm very happy about that.
Mideast envoy Steve Witkoff checked out the food distribution in Gaza, and CBS's Deborah Patter reports.
I must face death itself just to get a bag of flour. If I don't, we starve, he said. But it is flour mixed with blood.
CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keyes.
As Wisconsin is hitting the road on your Harley. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
It's the Brewers and the Nationals. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball, the Brewers and the nation's capital for game two of their series against the Washington Nationals. Milwaukee won by a landslide last night, 16-9. Blake Perkins with two home runs. Jackson Churiel placed on IL with a hamstring injury, so Brandon Lockridge, acquired in that trade with the Padres, came up with two hits. William Contreras with a home run and five hits, a new career high. Manager Pat Murphy.
Our guys were locked in. You know, they did a nice job. And you look at the output, you know, Contreras, Perkins, Vaughn, and Kelly gets a couple hits, and Lockridge gets a couple hits in his first game for us. You can't forget Perk's two homers, and Monasterio getting four hits. Joey Ortiz, you have five quality at-bats. Yeah, I mean, that's contagious.
NFL, the Packers hold practice inside Lambeau Field tonight for Family Night with sports on Mike Clemens.
As Wisconsin is cheering on Bucky Badger, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Hazy sunshine today, a high near 78. Tonight, partly cloudy, 63. Smoky sunshine for Sunday with highs in the upper 70s. 80 on Monday, 82 the high on Tuesday. Mostly sunny and mid-80s on Wednesday.
It's 64 at our studios.
I'm Rick Smith, host of The Rick Smith Show. If you're looking for honest talk, real stories, and straight-up news that matters to you, tune in to The Rick Smith Show. We're digging into the issues that affect your job, your family, your future. Join me weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network, because your voice deserves to be heard. That's The Rick Smith Show, heard weeknights at 9 right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
It's fun to look back and laugh now.
That was a bad day.
There are marriages that have died on less. Our first actual fight as a married couple was about the house rules of playing Monopoly. We've not really played Monopoly since. When you can modify an app, you can modify the rules of the game. Maybe there are times when you are better off just playing the computer. Play something else with your spouse instead.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Doctors Without Borders is delivering life-saving medical care where it's needed most in communities around the world. From bandaging war-wounded patients in Sudan to providing clean drinking water in Haiti, we're in more than 70 countries worldwide, bringing patients from sick to recovering, from emergency to aid, from crisis to care. This life-saving care is made possible by a global movement of supporters like you. Thank you.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
Every 15 seconds, someone is diagnosed with cancer. If it's happened to you or someone you love, the American Cancer Society can help at every step of the journey. Visit cancer.org today.
Pat Kreitlow.
On Monday morning, Up North News reporter Selena Heller will talk to Jimmy Cuska, Jane Mattinair.
And me.
Oh, that's Dr. Kristen Lierley. She'll be here too.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are talking about presidential authority once again and this very interesting oral argument that was had just this past week among the 11 judges of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit reviewing a decision of a lower court, the U.S. Court of International Trade, that had blocked these sweeping duties of the presidency, the authority of the president to impose tariffs of all things. And a seeming majority of the bench this past week in the Federal Circuit saying, you don't have the authority to do this, Mr. President. They are met with the argument from the president's attorneys, and those are the attorneys from the Department of Justice who say, well, wait a minute, we're going to be invoking this IEEPA. That is the International Emergency and Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA. And what does that say? Well, that says that the president can exercise the authority to do this in instances where there's an unusual or extraordinary threat to national security or the economy for which a national emergency has been declared. Now, in invoking that language, again, the IEEPA just says nothing about tariffs, nothing about levies of this sort. But in rolling out all these tariffs of recent weeks and months, Donald Trump has claimed that trade deficits and the flow of illicit drugs into our country across our borders have constituted this national emergency about which the IEEPA does, in fact, give him some authority. And that's the basis upon which the argument is made by your attorneys in front of the Federal Circuit just this past week that the president does have this authority. The members, the full members, all 11 of them of the court of on the Federal Circuit, the court, they're very skeptical. They haven't issued their decision yet, but probably coming sometime soon. Along the way, here's your piece of civics and your piece of law school as well, which we sometimes incorporate here on the broadcast. In addition to saying that the IEEPA does not authorize Donald Trump to engage in this tariff work, the lawyers for the small businesses and the states that were arguing against his authority also said the actions of the president violate this major questions doctrine and the non-delegation doctrine. There's some basic principles the Supreme Court has variously embraced and sometimes not embraced to prohibit various governmental actions. And what do those mean? Well, under the major questions doctrine, we've seen this in the past, an agency that seeks to decide a major issue that has some political or economic significance, something big, as the Chief Justice has said, and something new, big and new, has to have some clear authorization from Congress. That's the major questions doctrine. Only the Congress can implement those kinds of things. The argument here that the president, not only acting in violation of the Constitution, can't do this. It's big. It's new. And for that reason, major questions prohibits the president from doing this. Second, the non-delegation doctrine. Under that doctrine, Congress not able to delegate to give its legislative authority to an executive branch agency. Can't say, here, you do this, unless it sets out an intelligible and understandable, a reasonable, a clear standard, some judicially enforceable principle to guide that agency. Here, once again, saying that the Congress has not given up its authority to impose tariffs as the Constitution, James Madison and George Mason and others wrote many years ago. Non-delegation doctrine says you can't do this. And those doctrines as well seem to be favorably received by the members of the Federal Circuit just this past week. What a decision that would be if indeed they come back and say that all this tariff work, all this initiative underway, even in the hours of recent weeks, cannot go ahead because the president does not have the authority and his reliance on the IEEPA is unfounded. Now, of course, would that go to the Supreme Court? Of course it would. And the government, your Department of Justice, would certainly appeal it promptly to the Supreme Court for its review. But we now have another challenge to a fundamental thing that our president is doing along the way, coming out of the Federal Circuit in Washington, D.C. We'll see what they decide, along with other courts out there reviewing the actions of this president, this one having to do with tariffs and the legitimacy, the constitutionality of all of this. Question whether or not our president would follow that, even if this court or another court says, you can't do this, Mr. President. We do have issues in another area where the president has issued an executive order and appears to be moving even this past week in the wake of the stay, the 30-day stay of that major decision in that CASA case, C-A-S-A, in which the United States Supreme Court did not address the issue of birthright citizenship, whether you're born here, whether you therefore have a right to claim citizenship, or whether he is right, and that if you were born of parents who are illegally here, who are here only temporarily, you are not citizens. The Supreme Court in that major case, the single most important case of this past term, decided not to decide. And although they did say you can't have national injunctions, can't universally impose what one judge or even an appeals court may say across the country, that was their ruling coming from Amy Coney Barrett in that case, the last day of its major decisions. Even though they said that, no national injunctions, we've had a lot of activity in the wake of that. Judges, district court judges, and now appeals court judges also deciding what the Supreme Court did not, and saying across the board, uniformly, universally, that the prior decision of the Supreme Court in the late 19th century, saying that indeed, if you are born here in this country geographically, we don't need to look at your parents' heritage. You are a citizen of the United States of America. That's the precedent of the Supreme Court that the Supreme Court has not overturned. What do we know? We know in the wake of even that decision in CASA, we had district court judges who are saying we're going to go ahead and find that the president's executive order with his restrictive view on the 14th Amendment cannot stand. We know about Judge Joseph LaPlante. He is in New Hampshire who certified a class of all the newborn babies who might be subject to that executive order and said the class is certified. I'm protecting all of you. You are now all United States citizens. They don't know it yet because, of course, they're babies. They're babies just born since February of this year. We've got another judge. Her name, of course, is Deborah Boardman. She's in Maryland. She's said the same thing, that she is likewise going to do the same kind of thing if, in fact, when she gets a return report and a return order from her court of appeals, she is likewise going to do the same thing. That is Deborah Boardman. She is in the District of Maryland. And then we've got Leo Sorokin, S-O-R-O-K-I-N, just this past week. He's a district court judge in Massachusetts who does the same kind of thing. He says, you know what? The Supreme Court, having not decided this, I'm going to decide it, just like Judge LaPlante and just like Judge Boardman have done. I am finding that if you are born here in the United States of America, you are entitled to citizenship. And not defying the Supreme Court, but saying that that's the way the law should be. At least three district court judges across the country who are making that decision in the wake of the Supreme Court's non-decision on this issue. And now we've got even more judges, and they are at the appellate court level who are coming to the same result. Let's talk about those in the First Circuit and then also in the Ninth Circuit. The First Circuit, just this past week, on Friday, ready to become, believe it or not, the second court of appeals in the country to rule that President Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship is unlawful. It is unconstitutional. A three-judge panel of the Boston First U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, it's in Boston where they sit, spent about 2 hours looking skeptically at Donald Trump's executive order in a series of cases in which, again, many other courts, including those in the First Circuit, have said the executive order violates the Constitution. And in particular, this past week, the chief judge, his name is David Barron, there, B-A-R-R-O-N, of the U.S. Court of Appeals in the First Circuit, says this. He says, we have an opinion of the Supreme Court that we aren't free to disregard. That's Chief Judge David Barron. He's referring to that 1898 Supreme Court case. It is United States versus Wong Kim Ark. In that particular case, coming out of California, you have parents who are of Chinese ancestry and citizenship. They are here in California, in the United States. There is the birth of their son. The question is that son a citizen of the United States of America? And the Supreme Court uniformly, unequivocally says 1898 that their son is a citizen of the United States of America. Why? Because he was born on American soil. Other members of the panel just this past week said they required to stick with the holding in that case. Judge Julie Rickleman, R-A-K-E-L-M-A-N, said that the Trump interpretation is wrong. And the ask that the court adopt the dissenting opinion in that 19th century case simply is not what she is going to do in the First Circuit. She tells the DOJ attorney who's arguing again on behalf of the executive order, she says, we have to apply the majority decision, not the dissenting opinion, almost mocking, if you will, the position of the government attorney. A ruling against the administration here, likely coming from the First Circuit Court of Appeals, saying that the executive order cannot stand, would represent the second time. In addition to all these district courts, you also have appeals courts, the First Circuit, and also even before the First Circuit review of all this, the first time that a Court of Appeals has taken a look at this is the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That's that huge geographic swath of land, again, on the West Coast, also including Hawaii and Alaska, huge geographic area. That's the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. It said last month that, again, the Trump executive order cannot stand. And in a separate case, again, coming out of district courts there in the Ninth Circuit, finding that the president's executive order is unconstitutional, contrary to precedent, contrary to the law, contrary to what has been the understanding in America for well over 100 years, arguably even before the decision of the Supreme Court in that Wong Kim Ark case, saying that that cannot stand. So now the likely status is that sometime soon, the First Circuit Court of Appeals is going to join the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in answering the question that the United States Supreme Court did not answer, which is that the executive order cannot stand and that indeed the law is and should remain as it has been for all of recent history. And that is that children born this year in the wake of the executive order, they are babies born even of parents who are illegally here, who are here temporarily. All of that cannot stand. All of that, a part of what the appeals courts are doing, and all of that, a part of what the judges in America are assigned to do as they undertake the work and the initiatives, taking up these challenges to the president's decisions. When we come back in our final segment, some comments from at least one caller about many of the topics we've discussed today, and then also some observations about other things going on in the courts of our land as Amicus Law Review continues.
As Wisconsin is hitting the road on your Harley.
This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
540 WAUK presents This Week in Waukesha, a weekly podcast available anytime you want it.
Hey, it's Downtown Danny Brown, and this week in Waukesha, we are acting locally, thinking globally, talking about the floods in Texas. Who's to blame, and what can we learn about it here in Wisconsin? We're also going to honor the baseball's rising stars, especially at the local level, and then, of course, the politics of softball. Join us. It's going to be a great show.
This Week in Waukesha, a podcast always available online at waukradio.com.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Americans really like voting by mail and in-person early voting. That, according to 2024 statistics from the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. According to EAC, 158,211,780 citizens voted out of 211,144,275 active registered voters, a 74.8% turnout, 3 points lower than 2020. Among the 158 million voters, 52.8 million voted in person on Election Day. But far more Americans voted early, with 46.8 million voting early by mail and almost 48.9 million voting early in person. Mail-in voting accounted for 30.3% of votes cast, with some states offering universal mail balloting or permanent mail or absentee lists. Over 15 million ballots were returned via drop boxes in 36 states, up 10% since 2022. The percentage of in-person Election Day voters dropped in 2024 to only 37.4%, while in-person early voting jumped to 35.2%. The combination of mail and early in-person totaled 65.5%. It's clear that early voting is here to stay. We've linked to the report at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Where working people come to talk. It's the Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join me for an honest approach to the issues American working families care about. No talking points, no focus groups. Get ready for a heavy dose of democracy, fairness, grit, and no apologies. It's current affairs from a working class labor perspective. Facts are center, science is real, and everyone gets a seat at the table. The Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network.
As Wisconsin is cheering on the Brew Crew. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. This is the final segment of our two-hour program this weekend. Appreciate your attention. Appreciate your engagement on all of these issues. And yes, as I say with increasing frequency, it's a lot. It is a lot to digest. I appreciate that very much. I appreciate your interest in the civics aspect of these issues, in the law school stuff that we do on this radio broadcast as well. It is perhaps the one good thing that comes out of all of these challenges to the president's executive orders and other machinations coming out of this administration, that we also learn more about our judicial system, about how courts work, about the processes, the rules, the procedures, and even the doctrines that they apply on a regular basis. Appreciate your attention, acknowledging that it is a lot. We also appreciate here in our broadcast the comments and the involvement of all of our listeners, and that includes Mark, who calls in and also reports to us on the studio chat line about two of the issues we've discussed this weekend, and those include redistricting and gerrymandering. And about that, Mark notes that race and partisan politics are still entwined intimately, and goes on to note that it is interesting coming out of Louisiana that in the 4th District, Mike Johnson, of course, who is the Speaker of the House of Representatives, it is his district that is somewhat the focus of that Louisiana case that we talked about. The case is still before the Supreme Court when it comes to deciding whether a newly drawn map that includes two majority black districts should stand. Mark notes that it is 4th District. It's Mike Johnson's district. It resembles the very original gerrymander up there in Massachusetts, coming out of Eldridge Gerry's governorship at the time, and the cartoon of great fame that gives life to this notion of gerrymandering. Mark, appreciate very much your comment about not only the history here, but also about the fact that when it comes to Louisiana, comes to Texas, maybe comes to these other states, including California and Illinois and Missouri and Indiana, who knows how far this is going to go as we take up once again the issue of line drawing and gerrymandering in the nation. Some of it may be partisan, some of it may be racial. It's all intertwined. And that is Mark's point. And that certainly is one of the things with which courts need to wrestle. What is the nature of this line redrawing? What are the reasons for our doing it? And it affects dramatically the results. Mark also comments upon tariffs and notes, as we have noted here repeatedly, including in our weekend broadcast here, that the Constitution, he says, it's pretty clear. It is indeed pretty clear, Mark, that the Congress has the power to set tariffs. The way that the president is doing it, he says, is essentially taxation without representation. Mark goes on to say the founders were concerned, as discussed in various letters of the Federalist Papers, about a president setting policy for personal gain, and these tariffs fall in that category. Mark, appreciate very much your commentary about the authority of the president to impose these tariffs as we have seen them in recent months and weeks. Appreciate those comments, Mark, and appreciate the comments and the involvement of all of you here on our broadcast. A final note also about the work of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. We talked about them just a few moments ago in connection with their affirmation of the traditional meaning and purpose of the 14th Amendment. Just late Friday, the Trump administration suffered what can only be called another setback. You may recall well that there was a judge, we talked about her a lot, named Mame Frimpong, F-R-I-M-P-O-N-G. She is in the Federal District Court in Los Angeles. She had decided that the actions of various federal agents in detaining without suspicion, without an appropriate basis, without finding a basis to detain and even arrest people on the streets of Los Angeles cannot stand. On Friday, a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals affirms what Judge Frimpong has directed, telling basically the federal agents to stand down, or at least redirecting them to what the law of our nation has always been, that you have to have reasonable suspicion before you detain someone, before you arrest them on the streets of America, including Los Angeles. You can't simply base it upon how they look, upon their employment place, or some other characteristics that are not based upon a reason to believe that they're engaged in some kind of criminal activity. The three-judge panel of U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit affirming the lower court ruling that these kinds of actions relying exclusively on a person's race and some other factors, for example, like speaking Spanish, cannot form the basis for arrests and detentions. And of course, we know that the administration's raids there and the arrests, other things, have been a lot of focus of our national attention. All of that back in the news recently. The appellate judges wrote that the plaintiffs in this case are likely to succeed on the merits. Again, all of this in the nature of preliminary injunctions. They're likely to succeed in showing that federal agents made arrests based on how people looked, how they spoke, and where they lived or worked. And for that reason, they said that activity cannot go on. The civil rights groups that brought this case filed these suits on July 2nd, accusing the Trump administration of these unconstitutional sweeps. Since early June, nearly 3,000 people have been arrested. And that happening before and even in the wake of Judge Frimpong's order. the American citizens and immigrants who are illegal in the United States have been caught in this dragnet. Of course, even if you're not a citizen, you are entitled to the protections of due process and what our constitutional dictates provide. 61-page ruling. The appellate judges said it was likely the arrests were made without reasonable suspicion. And they added that because the arrests were part of a pattern of officially sanctioned behavior, they're likely to recur without court intervention. They have said it cannot go on. It's got to stop. And the Court of Appeals now affirming the lower court, saying you can't do this, likely headed to the Supreme Court again. We've got a lot on our docket of America, a lot on the docket of this broadcast. I thank you once again for staying with me on all of this. And I invite you back again next weekend as we take up the events, the circumstances, the times in which we live under the rule of law here in the United States of America. Have a good weekend, everybody.
This is 540 WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station. This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Allison Keyes. The questions over President Trump's relationship with the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein continue as Epstein accomplice Ghislaine Maxwell is transferred to a more comfortable prison after meeting with the Justice Department. CBS's Scott McFarlane.
In a statement issued Friday, relatives of Virginia Giuffre, Epstein's most vocal and visible abuse victim, blasted the Trump administration for transferring Maxwell, calling it a horror and outrage and preferential treatment. Earlier this week, Giuffre's family said they feared the president would pardon Maxwell.
The word that comes to mind is it would be an abomination.
The president has not ruled out clemency for Maxwell.
In Montana, a manhunt is underway for a man suspected of killing four people and is considered to be armed and dangerous. Montana Television Network reporter John Amy.
Many locals are shocked that Anaconda is now